Good evening, everybody, and welcome to tonight's event. I would like to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which we are gathered, the Wurundjeri and Boon Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation, and pay my respect to their elders, past, present, and future. Women's representation in leadership and politics is a critical issue for Papua New Guinea and Australia. It both reflects and exacerbates gender inequality in our societies. PNG now has no women in parliament following the 2017 national election. In the previous parliament, when three women were in office, PNG was ranked 186th in the world. It now slips to the bottom of the list alongside Yemen, Micronesia, and Vanuatu. PNG is not alone in the struggle for better gender equality in politics. Women are also significantly underrepresented in Australian politics, making up only 32% of the federal parliament and 24% of cabinet ministers. Australia has dropped from 20th in 2001 to 50th in the world for women in parliament in 2017. There is also a serious deficit of women in senior leadership positions in the private sector in Australia, although evidence shows that higher levels of female participation is better for business. Only 25% of ASX 200 company directors are women. On that list, there are more people named John. In PNG, the formal economy is small, and the country faces employment challenges, which disproportionately affect women. My name is Anna Kirk, and I'm a research fellow at the Lowy Institute and project director of the AusPNG Network, which is working to enhance the people-to-people links between Australia and PNG. Our countries have a unique relationship built on the foundation of our shared history. And we hope that events like tonight's will help broaden the conversation about PNG in Australia and encourage greater Australian interest in our nearest neighbour. Let me thank the NGV for including us in the triennial program, DFAT for their support of the AusPNG network, and Bank South Pacific for their sponsorship of the network event series. I'm excited to be joined by some very impressive women who are going to share their knowledge and experience with us tonight. Anne Sherry is one of Australia's leading business executives with a career that spans government, banking and tourism. She is now chairman of Carnival Australia, the largest cruise ship operator in Australasia. While she was CEO of Westpac New Zealand and Pacific and CEO of Bank of Melbourne, she was responsible for driving the corporate sustainability and diversity agenda. The Australian government awarded Anne the Centenary Medal in 2001, and in 2004, she was awarded an Order of Australia. In 2015, Anne was named overall winner of the Australian Financial Review 100 Women of Influence Award. Karen Baker is a research fellow in Pacific politics with the Department of Pacific Affairs at the Australian National University. Her research focus is on women's political representation. She has conducted research on legislative measures to increase women's representation, as well as the campaign strategies of women candidates in elections in PNG, Solomon Islands, Samoa, Tonga, and the French Pacific Territories. Rufina Pita stood for the central regional seat in PNG's 2017 national election. She was the highest polling female candidate, receiving over 33,000 votes, which saw her come in third. She has had a long career in PNG's public service and holds a Master of Agricultural Economics from the University of New England in Australia and a graduate diploma in business studies from Massey University in New Zealand. I'd especially like to thank Rufina for taking time off to travel all the way from Port Moresby for this event. Tonight, I want to cover four issues. First, women's representation in politics in PNG and Australia. Second, the situation for women in the private sector and the different barriers Australian and Papua New Guinean women face in their careers. Third, attitudes towards women in our societies. And finally, I want us to finish on an optimistic note. I will ask each of the panellists for ideas on how to support women to reach leadership positions. After I have moderated this conversation, I will turn to the audience for questions. So please, while you're listening to the discussion, start thinking of interesting questions. Rufina, let me start with you. You stood in the last election and had huge support, but were not elected. And of course, no other women were either. What do you think are the major challenges for Papua New Guinean women who want to break into politics? And did your view change following your experiences last year?
Thank you and good evening all. I think the important thing is for women to be ready, to be prepared for elections. I think generally we saw, even myself, that we got into making the decision to contest quite late. And it's really important for women to be able to make the decision up front, at least 4 years, and take 4 years to prepare, because there are obstacles that are quite challenging. The first one is the traditional cultural perspectives on leadership, and especially political leadership, for women to be involved in political leadership. So it is important, and every culture is different in PNG, and many of you know that it's very diverse in cultures, so it's very location-specific for women. And so as we look across, some have more significant challenges than others. Nonetheless, traditional culture is a challenge, and it has to be dealt with in plenty of time in terms of the awareness and everything that needs to go with it. As well, financial resources is another key challenge. And so again, if we make up our minds to run much earlier on and have 4 years to actually have a strategy in place in how to raise campaign finances, you'll be better prepared. Knowing what politics is about, political culture in PNG is another challenge that I think many of us go in naive. Many of us go in knowing that we know what it is, what the role of a parliamentarian is, but there is a lot more to learn. So I think in a nutshell, it's really the challenges are culture, finance, the political culture, so traditional culture and political culture. Again, political culture will differ in places. So where I come from in the central province is very different to what's up in the highlands. And so how you prepare for that, women who want to go into politics, it's also will take time, and it takes all those 4 years to plan and tick the checklist. So those are some of the critical things. Getting support from family is really crucial. I mean, I think that's in every important decision that happens. But in PNG context, family goes beyond nucleus family to extended family, to tribes, tribal groupings. And it's also really important. Many women will find, if they express their intention in the last, quite late into the game, someone else, a cousin or an uncle or someone else, male relative might be running, and it's really hard to actually let a male relative step down and for you to go up. So it's really wise for women. I think the biggest thing is for us to be ready in plenty of time.
And I was wondering if you could also explain for us what kind of costs are involved in running for elections in PNG?
Yes, cost is quite an issue, and the significant proportion of the cost in any election is really in logistics. And obviously it depends on the constituency, but a lot of constituencies have difficult terrains. For example, I didn't get to visit two districts and about six or seven LLGs within the four districts in the constituency that I ran in, because I had to get a chopper to get there, and it's about 15,000. to get a chopper, and you cannot, you know, the turnaround time also is, you know, it's like high and by and get back on and go back to Port Moresby. So that is logistical cost is makes up the significant proportion of any election costs. So in my case, it cost me about, I think, 100,000 that I know of, but I know there are people who spent cash just for coordination and all of that in other places. So it would have gone up to about 150,000 to 200,000. This is cash I'm talking about. Forget about everything else that also came on. So, and this is a regional seat. This is the whole of Central Province, so it's much, much bigger. So for a regional seat, I would think that you would be looking at a minimum of 500,000. If you get to prepare over 4 years, you might do, you know, it's about visibility. So over 4 years, when you've actually strategized and covered your constituency by profiling it and knowing who's there, what's there and all of that, you know, you should bring that cost down. But if you go in the last minute, it can be that much.
Mm.
Yes.
I wanted to ask Karen and Rufina, do you think there is a role for quotas to ensure women's representation in PNG politics? Karen, we'll start with you.
Absolutely. I'm very pro quotas. I think that they're not only good for women, but they're actually good for everyone. A lot of my research is in this area, and evidence shows that the quality of leadership and governance actually goes up once you introduce a quota. And that's because you might lose some kind of less well-performing men, but the more capable men stay in politics and they're joined by equally capable women. So a lot of arguments against quotas kind of rest on the idea of merit. And a lot of people think that there's something intrinsically unfair about quotas. And that's, you know, that's what a lot of people think. And I think we have to accept that. But at the same time, the reality is quotas actually provide a level playing field so that merit can win out. Like, quotas are actually a good thing if you want a meritocratic system. So I do really support the use of quotas, not just in PNG, but pretty much everywhere. I will say, in PNG, I think that the conversation about quotas could be broader. Like, a lot of the conversation is focused around reserve seats or nominated seats, but I think if you look elsewhere in the Pacific, there's some really interesting models that that could also be used in PNG. And I'm thinking particularly of the quota that's used in Samoa, which is a safety net style system that was used for the first time in the 2016 election. And their quota is that basically they set a minimum level of women's representation, and in Samoa that's 5 women MPs, and you have a general election, and if fewer than 5 women are elected, then additional women members come into the House, and those women are the highest polling unsuccessful women candidates. So what you have is a system where everyone contests in the same election, men and women are running for the same seats, and the quota only kicks in if that threshold isn't met. So it's a backup system rather than reserve seats that are already in place. So I think it circumvents a lot of the criticisms around reserve seats. And it also means, like in Samoa in the 2016 election, what you saw was advocates of women's representation who supported quotas, and then as well as people who were very anti-quota, who didn't want the quota to happen. They were all working towards the same goal, right? They all wanted at least 5 women to get into parliament so that you didn't have to use the quota at all. So I think it, like, in terms of quotas are always going to be controversial, but I think that the Samoan model has a lot of value in terms of the bringing people on board with the system that you have in place.
Mm. Rufina, what do you think about quotas?
I think in the PNG context, my view is that it is necessary to have a quota system, and in particular the 22 reserve seats that has been worked on for quite a while. And I think it went through two readings on the floor of Parliament, and on the third one it was not passed. It didn't have the majority votes required to pass the bill. It is important because culture is about mindsets, and mindsets don't change overnight. It takes years to change mindsets. And so if we continue to say, okay, women, you go the way that everyone else is going and get elected, the perceptions are still there that women are not as good political leaders as men are. And that's coming out of a culture that is largely patrilineal, and men make decisions and men hold meetings and make decisions. And there's nothing wrong with that, but when you come into the Western society, in the Westminster type of parliament that we have adopted, the scenario changes. So it's people who know what it is. The most appropriate person for the job should be the person to get it, whether you're male or female. So against that cultural backdrop, I think it's really necessary that we do have a quota, giving the women the opportunity to actually perform as political leaders on the floor of parliament through that system. And so people can judge for themselves to say, oh, women can be good political leaders as well. So for that reason, I think it is necessary to have a quota system in PNG to encourage women to be in parliament and to demonstrate their capability of being equally good or even better political leaders.
Thank you. And let me turn to you. The Australian and PNG contexts are very different, and you are familiar with them both through your work with PNG. What kind of challenges do you think Australian women with political aspirations face? Are there any similarities to what Rufina explained to us earlier?
Well, I think women in this part of the world face similar political challenges, but they manifest in different ways. I think in Australia we have a very old-fashioned selection process for politicians, dominated by parties and committees largely made up of old white men, so to put it bluntly. And so we wonder why more women don't get pre-selection for safe seats, don't get and get dispirited when the process is designed for a particular outcome. So that's only changed in areas where there's been a deliberate decision to improve the number of women coming through and to support women. So there's a lot of similarities, I think. Emily's list that was created by Labor here about 20 years ago now set out to find good women candidates, train them, support them, raise money for them. And as a result of that, there's a number of women who've gone into politics at state and federal level in Australia who perhaps would not have before. But there's still not enough women standing. Ironically, one of the great outcomes in the US of such a mad political outcome there has been a whole movement to get women to stand for politics in the US. So you don't end up where we are now again. I'm not sure it guarantees that, but the need for more women in Parliament. I think the difference, so the similarities are that there's systems are weighted against women, they're weighted towards the past, not the future. There's not an underlying acceptance that women should be in politics, I think, in both systems. There is with some individuals, but not in general terms. And I think, to the point that was made earlier, merit is the mask behind which everyone hides. And so, well, if they're any good, they just get elected on their merit. Well, if only the process had anything to do with merit, that might be true, but in neither case is that so. So I think the added complexity in PNG is the piece of legislation that was referred to the Dame Carol, who was the proponent of that, fought really, really hard to get that up, and it just fell over at the last minute. Is that where you've got systems with no women in the 21st century and countries that need women's voices at the highest level and at all levels to deal with the issues that they're facing economically, politically, socially, then you've really got a system that just is skewed in the wrong way. And I think it's in the Pacific, which is on our doorstep. You know, our nearest neighbours in the Pacific are some of the worst performers in the world. And we're not in a good position to be lecturing to anybody. But regionally, I think we need to take a really good hard look at ourselves and then look at who are in the top 10. Most of those countries have had imposed quotas. Most of them have had great politicians elected. Many of them have had women who've been elected through those systems become their prime ministers. They've been so good. So, you know, let's have a look at the data sets around where it's working and what's happened. And then you have to put aside, I think, some of the assertions about, you know, if only women stood up, or if only women could do more, or if only women did something. The reality is the systems have to change to support women's participation. And, you know, I think increasingly societies are demanding that. So I told the story earlier before any of you arrived that I saw Peter O'Neill after that election and said to him that I was shocked that there was not a single woman in his parliament. And he looked at me as though I'd arrived from Mars, which actually often happens, but this was a particular look. And he just didn't know what to say. He actually did not know what to say to me. He's got an answer for everybody, usually. He did not know what to say. And I think he was a bit surprised that anybody would take it up as an issue. And I think that's the problem in places that don't have women now. They've lost track of what's happening around them in their own countries, but also in the world around them. And I think that's a dangerous place to be if you're a politician.
I have a question for Karen now, speaking of our region and women examples. Karen, you're a Kiwi. Let me ask you about Jacinta Ardern's recent pregnancy announcement. During the campaign last year, her response to questions from media about whether she had plans to start a family garnered international attention. And this is the latest example of the tension between balancing family and work that women experience. Do you think this is still a key barrier for women reaching leadership positions?
Yeah, it's really exciting. Yeah. I'm quite a proud New Zealander right now. But I think, like, it does speak to the challenge, as you said, of balancing work and childcare, how this was such an issue during the campaign period. And, of course, people are also making an issue of it now. I think politics and motherhood, it's always going to be difficult, but it's really important to have these role models like Jacinda, like Larissa Waters breastfeeding in the Senate. Like, these are important symbols that kind of demonstrate that you actually can make politics compatible with your life. I also think in the case of New Zealand, it's really important that we've had kind of a diversity in experiences with our three female prime ministers that we've had. The first female prime minister, Jenny Shipley, had adult children when she became prime minister. And then, of course, Helen Clark chose not to have children. And now we have Jacinda Ardern, who's starting a family during her political career. And I think all of those kind of work together to demonstrate, you know, different approaches and different avenues that you can take. And I think that's the value of, you know, going beyond that first of having having more than one role model to look up to if you're a woman hoping to enter politics. But yeah, it's a really exciting time.
And she'll kill it. Yeah, she'll kill it. I mean, she's a really capable woman, and she thought long and hard about going into politics. In fact, when the leadership was first talked about, she said she didn't want it. Yeah. And then she got it, and then she got elected. And she was pregnant during the election campaign, and she knew it. And she will have a baby and life will go on, as it does for most of us. And I think the point you've made about New Zealand being on its third female prime minister also makes quite a big difference. There was a lot of questions asked of her about having a family. The fact that she was female was less of an issue. Because, she's the third female prime minister in New Zealand in not that many years, and New Zealand has prospered under all of them. Mm-hmm. So that's less the question that's asked now. And I think you're right, there's a power of role modelling in that changes a community dynamic. Mm-hmm. Ironically, when I lived in New Zealand, there was a female Governor-General, a female Chief Justice and a female Prime Minister, and people used to laugh that boys wonder what they can be when they grow up. It's like, well, if that was only the only problem we had to deal with, let's bring it on.
So now to discuss women in the private sector. Anne, you have had a very impressive career. Can I ask you to reflect on the changes that you've seen in your time in the business world and how being a woman has changed the equation for you?
Wow. In 30 words. Look, a lot has changed since I've been in business. And as you said at the beginning, I didn't start there. I started in government, trade union. I've worked in lots of different sectors. But in the time that I came into business and I came into banking, which was pretty hard-boiled, in the mid-90s, it wasn't a welcoming environment, let's say. One of the things I figure is that life is short and that if you're going to make change, if you get the opportunity to make change, then you do it. So I've spent the last 20 years making as much change as I can influence. I've got to quite powerful positions. I've been CEO of quite a few organisations now. And I think those jobs give you the opportunity to make change and require change. And ultimately, that's how things do change. It's got to be led. There's lots of people advocating for change, but ultimately, you've got to have leaders prepared to do it. And I think perhaps that's the change we're starting to see now. There's more leadership thinking about change in organisations, not just women leaders, but men leaders, male leaders as well, who've worked out that the world will not get better unless there's a lot more change, unless they stand beside women to make change. So I think that fundamentally is a shift that I've seen. Having said that, though, I think there's still lots of places, there's plenty of rocks we still need to lift up and you find a toad under it. It's my Queensland heritage. So there's still lots more to do, and I look at younger women and think, it just shouldn't be this hard. We shouldn't be debating merit. We should actually be not using merit as an excuse for things not to happen. We shouldn't still be have women trying to work out how they balance having kids and working. It shouldn't be that hard. We do have a lot more accomplished women rising to the top. So I'm optimistic. I think the change is too slow. And I think each of us needs to find a way of changing the stuff we think is wrong. And in the same way as, the famous quote from Chief of Army, that you set culture and tone by the things you're prepared to walk past, is really good for all of us to keep remembering, because all of us see stuff. And I think that's the power of Me Too. Mm. That actually is now just called out stuff that people had just let go and lots of people had walked past. And when you call it out and shine a light on it, it's much harder to ignore. It's much harder to think it's okay. And it's much harder for perpetrators of things that just shouldn't be happening to continue to do it unabashed, and it empowers the women as well, women who've been treated poorly, to continue to stand up. So I think that's unleashed now a whole mechanism for change perhaps to be accelerated in organisations at every level.
Mm. And do you think that women have advantages over men in business?
It's an interesting question. I think some women do. Mm. Gifts aren't equal, but it's interesting to watch women in organisations who listen and therefore hear what's really going on, when the cultural norms are often not to listen. It's interesting to watch women be more supportive of other women and other people in their parts of the organisation when, again, cultural norms aren't about support, they're about competition. And now, I'm not sure that's just because they're women. I think that's because they believe it's right. So I think women behaving well and doing the right thing in organisations ultimately do have advantages because they get better outcomes. And that's why we need more women in leadership. It's why we need more women in politics, because they bring a different dimension often to and challenge cultural norms that have been the same for a long time and are not serving us as a community that well.
Mm. Rufina, one more question for you. PNG's formal economy is small and simply gaining employment is challenging. What does an Australian audience need to understand about PNG's development challenges and how they affect women?
Okay, so as you rightly said, I think about 25 to 30% of our economy is the formal sector and the rest of it is informal sector. And so most of the people live in rural areas, 87% of the population. And so it is important, and given the geography of the country, with the majority of the people in the rural areas, be it men or women, transport infrastructure is really, really important, as well as communication. So the key challenges I think we face in terms of employment, which a lot of that employment will come from agriculture sector and other renewable resource sectors. However, if we do not develop the infrastructure, transport, communication, and other market infrastructure that's needed, then you have that mass of people in the rural areas who find it really hard to bring their produce to the markets or to the buyers. So that's quite a significant impediment to development and to income earning opportunities for the people in the rural areas. The experience has shown that where the road infrastructure has not been developed, has been underdeveloped, but even where it's developed, maintenance of roads infrastructure is not, it doesn't seem to take priority. And so the roads that are built also tend to run down over time, and that causes increased hardships for people in those renewable resource sectors that are in the rural areas, but who at the same time are the largest providers of employment for the informal sector. So, for example, where I come from, it's not far from Port Moresby, it's about 6 hours. This is 6 hours in a Land Cruiser, 4x4 Land Cruiser, nothing else. And during rainy season, the people have to commute to Port Moresby to get whatever they need. But the same transport is used to bring produce down. So obviously very high losses when it's agricultural produce. And in many remote areas, that's a similar story. In the areas where the road is good, the road access is good, and you have markets, it's different. Yeah, it's better. But in those areas, it's also about organizing farmers to produce the quantities that's required, the quality and the quantity that's required for a market to be able to get the price that they require. At the moment, most of the farmers will go to informal markets and sit there and sell. And whatever they can't sell, you know, they'll just reduce the price because they have to go home. But organizing the markets, organizing the farmers in such a way that they can bring their produce, which is of a certain quality, to a main point, to someone who can coordinate all of that buying and then bring it to the market. That's an area that still needs a lot of work in. I'm talking about fresh produce here. In the cash crop sector, again, it's also about other utilities like power. You know, if you have electricity readily available, you will have coolers out there on site for farmers to produce, bring their produce, store it, and bring it out. But because we don't have that electricity supply out there where people need it, it's also quite burdensome for people. In the tree crop sector, it's different. A lot of our coffee, cocoa, and copra has now gone down, but especially cocoa and coffee, they're very well established industries with an industry board that regulates quality to export and to monitoring prices. So that's quite a different ball game. And a lot of people who go in there, it's a sure market. You can sell what you produce. So, you know, that's good. But at the end of the day, you still have to, if you're in remote areas, you still have to transport your beans to the buyer in the major center. So just looking at the enabling environment in terms of roads, good roads in terms of power supply and other utilities in the districts and where private sector players can feel that they have that environment, enabling environment to actually set up in districts and may bring the market right down to the districts. It's not there, so you don't really get them. And the people have to actually bring it, in most cases, to the major centres.
Mm. So quite a different context to the boardrooms and offices of Australia, but still one that's challenging for women.
But if I can add, we do have a very young and rich entrepreneurial people coming up now in all sectors, actually. I'm really amazed at the talent that we have now. And even people who have been in the industries for longer, there's innovation, you can really see creative ideas coming through. And that's, I think, from exposure as well and some of this cross exchange. Like, for example, the Australian Women in Agriculture, they've had quite an input in how PNG women organise themselves from actually getting the Women in Agriculture, PNG Women in Agriculture registered, and actually helping them to find colleges here in Cairns, TAFE College. So some of the women and a couple of men farmers came, had training, and had their practical in farms just up the tablelands and around that area. And going back, you know, it just brought a new, whole new experience and new dimension to other farmers. And for them to actually translate that into how they did farming. So all of those things are happening at different levels. But I see the ICT is what is really, really, you know, helping PNG in terms of how markets are done. I mean, I bought two things in the social media that we have. We have about four or five different markets, e-market sites. So people just go in there and post. It's amazing how many people do buying and selling. And I actually bought about three things off that. Just got dropped off right at my workplace. So things are changing dramatically. And some of that is actually going down to the rural areas in terms of price information. Okay, this is the price for this. Then people at the farm level decide where they go to. So it is changing. But it doesn't reduce the need for that, making sure investment in infrastructure, but transport market is there to facilitate
to give women more opportunities,
yes,
and men,
yes,
the rural communities.
Yep.
I did have some questions on attitudes to women, but we're running close to time, so I wanted to finish on a positive note and ask each of you to think about what more we can do to support women to reach leadership positions, and whether there's a way that ambitious Australian and Papua New Guinean women can support each other. Anne, would you like to start?
Sure. Well, I think there's lots of things we can do jointly. I mean, obviously, I do spend quite a bit of time in PNG, and our commitment to women in PNG has been at a whole lot of levels. One, to support entrepreneurship, because there are lots of women, in, and particularly in regional communities, who are hungry, capable, and looking for opportunity. So as we develop places where I take the ships, for example, we always find women in those markets and communities, and we support them. We take them to other parts of the Pacific as well as to Australia so they can see what's possible. Mm-hmm. And they take that home and use it to create opportunity for themselves, their families and their communities. So I think there's very practical things we can do in a business sense, and there's lots of Australian businesses doing business in PNG. So we need to do that deliberately. That's one. I think secondly, we need to find more mechanisms to work across the across politics, because I think there's some activity that happens, but I think there could be more. And in other parts of the world, I've seen women be elected as a result of women in another country raising funds for them, making sure they had the resources they needed. So I'm sure there's an opportunity for us to do more across that boundary as well. And then finally, I think the one of the great powers of travel is that you go to places and you meet people. And interesting, I've watched over the last few years the tourism in PNG go from essentially the Kokoda track, which was most of it. Mm-hmm. Other than business travel, there was only about 5,000 real tourists a year going to Mount Hagen Show and to walk the Kokoda. There's now 60,000 tourists a year. And those tourists go to different parts of PNG, but all of those people come back having had some direct engagement. And I think harnessing the opportunity of travel, and I notice Maureen and Tony Wheeler are patrons of this, so I think there's a great power to people going to countries, meeting people face-to-face and finding ways then of engaging, because there's a lot that we could do through personal engagement to support women, whether it's in PNG or other parts of the world that we travel. And I think just thinking about that as we travel, rather than being observers, being more actively engaged, and that's a huge opportunity.
And also a lot of lessons that we in Australia can take from Papua New Guinean women, who are extremely resilient, hardworking people and very inspirational. Karen?
Well, I think in terms of political leadership, in PNG there's obviously a lot of structural barriers to deal with, and I think to get more women into politics, you need to deal with money politics, and you need to deal with electoral malpractice, and definitely need to think about introducing some kind of quota. But I also think it's really important to look at how best to support the women who are already really doing really well, including Rufina. And I think something that is kind of forgotten in the press about the 2017 election and no woman being elected is that there were quite a few women who did really, really well. And kind of coming second or third or fourth, it's not winning, but in a context where you've got, you know, 30 candidates on average contesting any seat, it's really impressive. And it shows a huge amount of, you know, credibility and competitiveness as a candidate. So I think while we have to deal with the structural barriers, so we have to work through them, obviously. It's also important to just kind of acknowledge the accomplishments of women like Rufina, who in this really difficult, hostile context are really excelling.
Yes.
Thank you. Okay, so I think that internally, it's important to mentor young women coming up at the different levels in the political arena, but also in private sector and public sector. and civil society as well. So really getting our house in order locally is important domestically. So in those areas, if we have platforms where we can mentor the younger generation of women coming through, that would be an important step to take. I mean, I think in my time I've seen how women and opportunities given to women have accelerated more recently. There was a time that you didn't really see anything happening, but more recently, a lot of things have happened. Regardless of the fact that we have in political leadership, we haven't really done well. In other areas, in PNG, in the public sector, private sector, we've actually seen women come up the ladder as well. So that's positive. But how do we keep women coming through, the younger generation, like better prepare them so the pace at which they go is accelerated. So that's the first thing. The other thing, I think, in terms of women in politics, I would agree with Karen to say that I think how we've been getting assistance is, okay, towards election time, you know, for example, DFAT and UNDP would come and just cast a wide net and get everyone in who is interested. I think we need to think differently now. I think we need to, in terms, if we're going to increase our success rate of getting women in there, we need to see, exactly as you said, who are the most likely to get in there and focus our attention and resources so we actually get some people, some women on the floor of parliament. So trying to step back and look at strategy, how are we approaching things and, do something differently. And I think in terms of women in political leadership, I think that is one way to go about doing it. Instead of going wide, let's narrow it down to women whom we think will have better chances of getting in. I think at the community level, as I share the experience of the Australian Women in Agriculture, PNG Women in Agriculture, to me that is such a success story. I mean, since then, women have been coming for the annual general meetings that Australian Women in Agriculture hold. And there's so many women, and these are women right from the grassroots, they actually save up to come to see how else things are done here. So that, people-to-people connections at different levels, I think, just finding out how we can, if it's not existing, how can we make it happen? If it's existing, what are the other platforms and places that we can link up? So, for example, what you are doing now, that's an excellent platform, PNG Australia network, where you bring young leaders as well as people like us coming and talking and sharing more about what is the context in PNG? But it's also the other way. What am I learning from, you know, how Australia is doing things, but at different levels? So I think, those are some of the ways I think that we can work together for women, but also just in general, people to people learnings, yeah.
Some more things to add to my to-do list. So thank you very much, panelists. Now we can take some questions from the audience. I'd ask you please to identify yourselves and ask a question, not a statement, and keep them brief and wait for the microphone, please. We might take three at once.
Hi, my name's Sally. Really enjoyed it so far, but my question, not my statement, is to Rafina. I really was interested to hear about the need to have a long running time before an election, so 4 years, for women to prepare and everything. How are women choosing to run? Are they self-selected or are they being provided, you know, supported through frameworks and things like that?
Excellent.
Sorry, we'll just take a couple more questions. Okay, sorry, sure, Regina. Sure. Yeah.
Hi, my name's Caroline. I work with the International Women's Development Agency. I have two questions. The first is I'm really interested in your reflections on the role of local government and local leadership as a pathway into national leadership when we look at the Sustainable Development Goals targets around women's political participation. It talks about national level and local level. And my second question is around the debate on caring work and your ideas and strategies for shifting the public discourse away from working mothers to working fathers and working parents, and what we need to do to create that shift.
Thank you. There were some down the front here.
Hello, my name's Helen Hill. I currently live in Timor-Leste, in East Timor, a country which has been very successful in getting a lot of women into the parliament and also as ministers. And I'm just wondering, and of course the reason that they found it easy to do is because their electoral system is one which is a closed list system, and each party has to pre-select every third candidate a woman on their list. Now, I just wonder if Papua New Guinea has ever thought about changing its constitution to have a multi-member. I know you have a single-member constituency, which is the hardest possible system to get women elected, and I'm just wondering if there's been any debate about changing to a multi-member system where you would even have some reserved seats for men as well as women, and some other seats that were not reserved for either gender, or getting, you know, to have a quota, you've got to have more than... It's easier if you have more than one candidate being elected in an electorate. I think a weakness of the Timorese system is that nobody represents an area. There's one electorate. The whole country is one electorate. But I think the other thing is, and I'd like to ask you more about this, what is the role of the political parties? Because it's the political parties in Timor that train, that identify. They have youth groups, they have women's groups, they campaign, and people come up through those groups. And I'm just wondering, what sort of groups do the PNG women come up through? Do they come up through parties or through church groups or girl guides or Country Women's Association, or what sort of social movements? Because if you don't have an experience in a social movement, it's very difficult to become a good politician, I think.
We'll take one final question from this young lady.
Hello, my name is Evodia Masoro. I'm an Australia Award Scholar at the University of Melbourne. My question is to Rufina. I wanted to ask, what role does educational attainment play in ensuring women leaders in PNG? And in your experience, how has that translated in your clan or family? And do you find that it equals the playing field, or are we still being held back by, cultural obligations? Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so there were a few questions for Rufina there. How are women selected? And what's the role of local government and local leadership? And what role does educational attainment play for women leaders in PNG?
Okay. So I'll respond to them in that order, but if I forget the questions, then you let me know.
I can remind you.
Okay. So we don't really have our political system is not set up in such a way that, I guess it's not mature enough, where you have people coming through the party system to be then nominated to stand for a certain constituency. So at the moment, a lot of women just put up their hands and run, and many have not had any affiliation to any party. But now we know that it's important, so you need to affiliate to a party. That's one of the things to do things in the 4 years. Identify a party, affiliate to it, and work with the party over the 4 years leading to the elections. So I hope that answers both your questions. There isn't the political system, political party system is not mature enough in the sense that the identification and selection and the grooming of people, whether it's man or woman, to come through until they are nominated for a constituency. That's not happening at the moment.
And the role of education.
The women. Role of education. There were a lot of very well-educated women who ran in the last elections. So I don't think people are recognizing, educational qualification is not really there yet in terms of people recognizing that as a characteristic for someone who should be qualifying for that political office. I'm not sure whether it's restricted to women. I don't think so. But, so I think the cultural affinities are still playing such a big role. So, for example, if there were two people standing, and one is not as educated as the other, but he has his a chief or has a that kind of coming from that background or a big man, people will go for that person rather than the educated elite. So. Education, unfortunately, not yet. We're not really there yet in terms of people saying someone who is going to be a parliamentarian and represent me on the floor of parliament needs to have some basic minimum level of education to know what the policies, what legislation, international relations, all of that. It doesn't really matter when it comes to voting day, unfortunately. It's still, I think, generally speaking, it's still the case.
Okay.
Just add to that. My observation is that once you're elected, it matters. So yes. The ministers tend to have, many of the ministers have been educated in Australia and other parts of, or the US even. So a lot of the ministers have very good tertiary education. So that's where it kicks in, not do you get elected or don't you get elected. But that's, we need to get women elected for then they can be recognised for their skills and become ministers. And that's the tipping point, it seems, at the moment anyway. That may change, but at the moment that's where
it sits. Even when they got elected, many of the women have only held the community development portfolio. It's like, women, that's your portfolio. You can't do anything else. That's been there, except for the first woman who was given a ministerial portfolio under Grand Chief Somare. That was Naharuni. She was the justice minister then. But apart from that, mostly community development, and more recently was higher education minister. Yeah.
Karen, could you please comment on the question about the Timor-Leste example and the role of pre-selecting women and potentially changing the constitution in PNG?
Sure. Obviously, the closed-list quota model has been the most successful at getting large numbers of women elected in the Pacific. It's true in Timor-Leste and in the French Pacific as well, in New Caledonia and French Polynesia, which has 56% women in its legislature, so one of the highest rates in the world. And that's down to a closed-list quota. But what you can see from the French Pacific is in Wallis and Futuna, which doesn't have a strong party system, has the same quota law, but it just doesn't work as well as it does in New Caledonia and French Polynesia because it doesn't have the strong parties. So you've got 20 seats, you have up to 20 parties getting elected, and so if you're not in that first position on the list, then it doesn't actually matter. You have very little chance of getting elected. So I think in PNG, it just because of the weak party system, introducing a quota like that just wouldn't work. So you have to look at other avenues.
And Anne, can we finish with your thoughts on changing the discourse about working mothers to working fathers or working parents?
I think from a, and your question, you said you're from UNDP, I think, didn't you? The IWD, okay. I think that discourse needs to change in developed and developing countries. countries. And we're struggling to change it here. So it's 100 times harder in a country where women have no option for caring and where men are very reluctant to be part of a caring structure. So I think that's, I mean, as we know from the various goals that have been set, unless that changes, it's very, and it takes time to change, but unless that changes in some way, there's lots of women who will struggle to find capacity to come out from their caring responsibilities to do employment, to do business, to do politics, to do other things. So, and what will happen is probably what happened here initially, which is that older women start to do those things and then start to make changes for younger women. I think it's very difficult when there's lots of stuff layered against you when you're younger, as it has been here. But I do think that's a pretty fundamental shift that as communities we need to make, is that parenting is not just the province of women, and caring is not just the province of women, that caring and child rearing is everyone's responsibility, and we need to find the structures to make that work in the same way as we need to find political structures that make women's participation work as well. But that is a big conversation, and it requires a lot of support, and it requires a lot of courage to really get that to make those challenges happen. But you know, it's ultimately where we've got to head to make sure that we use our human capital well in this part of the world, and it's ultimately where we've got to head. If we want our men and women to grow up, our boys and girls to grow up thinking that the world is their collective oyster rather than heading off in different directions. So I don't have the answer to that by any stretch of the imagination, I have to say, and if I did, I would have implemented it somewhere. but what I do know is that investing in education and children's services is a really important step, everywhere in the world, is a really important step in unleashing the opportunity for women and unleashing the opportunity as well for men to change their role slightly and become more engaged with their kids. But unless you've got good services, and PNG, as we know, has very patchy services for education and particularly for early childhood services, very little at all. So that's should be a focus for lots of the development work in the region.
Well, the conversation could go on, but it's time for us to wrap up. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. I've certainly learned a lot from these inspirational women. So please join me in thanking them.